doing good. And well, we're starting, I guess, at Michael Cal and whoever else is joining. Doug, Rivka. So let's give him a minute. Address the people online, they just type in how the sound is for today. I know last week we had a problem. Hey Doug, how are you?
Hi Ridley, how are you?
Good, all right. Just doing a little test here to see, last week we had a little audio issue people didn't pick up. Not everybody picked up the audio, so I'm just hoping that that's resolved. So I'm just waiting for people online to just confirm. Did they pick up the audio okay? Was that?
I'd love to sneak in a loosely related question at some point if we have time.
Why don't you do it right now? That'll be used as the audio okay. Test.
Okay. The question is, in Deuteronomy 18:20, it states that if somebody, a prophet comes along and says something that God hasn't told them, that, let me grab the exact text, that they're not to be believed. And in 21 and 22, it asks how you should know that. And it says, if the prophet will speak in the name of Hashem and that thing will not occur, then that's the word that God hasn't spoken. So in the opening article of Rabbi Chaik's book, he mentions that a... Almost there, I think. He says, Nachmanides states further that were it not for the event at Mount Sinai, we would not know that we should reject a false prophet who performs miracles and tells us to abandon any of the laws or ways of the Torah. So my understanding is that the sages, or at least Nachmanides, is saying anybody who tells you to abandon the law of the Torah is considered a false prophet. But in the footnotes to the art scroll version of Deuteronomy 18:21, it states that Austin, which pages go with which here? Once it's been established that someone is a prophet, he need not prove himself every time he speaks, and within limitations, even has the right to suspend certain commandments of the Torah. So this is saying that prophet has the right to suspend certain commandments of the Torah, but Rabbi Chaim's quote of Maimonides says that a person cannot, a prophet cannot tell you to abandon any of the ways of the Torah. Now, depending on how we interpret the word suspend, those two positions sound contradictory.
Okay.
So I'm just looking for clarification on that question.
Right, so the point is that there's another injunction from the Torah, and that is called Hora'ashah, temporary ruling. So
Hora'ashah means what again?
Hora'ah is actually the word Torah, which means ruling or teaching. So Hora'ashah, which means a ruling for a moment, a ruling for a certain limited amount of time. So that Torah has a statement in the Torah that says, "Eis la'asos Hashem hefer Torah sechet." There's a time when you'll have to do something for God, and you could nullify His Torah. So what does it mean? Is a time to do something for God, nullify His Torah? It means at certain times it'll be impossible that the Torah can be followed exactly in every single time and every single situation. For example, when it was necessary for Elijah to disprove the idolatry of Baal, so he created altars where he shouldn't have made them, but he did it only temporarily because it was necessary for the greater good. So there you're allowed to do that temporarily. A person has a right, the rabbis have a right actually to temporarily suspend the law. They can't permanently suspended. Okay, so that would resolve the issue that, on the one hand, the Torah says that, you know, if a prophet comes and tells you to abandon even one of the mitzvos of the Torah, so then you know he's a false prophet. But that's only if he says permanently to remove it. But if he says temporarily it's okay. Because it's necessary in certain events, certain times, to do something which is a technical violation, but you have another injunction in the Torah which says that you are allowed to temporarily violate something if it's for the greater good. Like, for example, writing down the oral law was a prohibition. But the rabbis saw that if they didn't write it down at a certain time, the whole Torah would be lost. So they had to violate at that time the law of not writing down the oral law in order for the greater good that the Torah should be perpetuated.
Rabbi?
Yes.
That there were a lot of Jews that went over to help save the victims in the Haiti situation, and that they were told not to observe Shabbat because it was more important to save lives. Would that be a situation like that?
Yeah, for example, if a Jew... I'm not sure what the all the specifics are, but yes, there is that fact that you can break the Shabbos to save a life.
Okay. Thank you. You should know that your voice is cutting kind of a little bit in and out.
Well, I think somebody's mute, but somebody has the mute is not put on. I think if everybody puts on their mute button, then tell me how it sounds, because I think that's causing it. So if everybody can put on your mute, I think that will resolve the problem of me being cut off. All right, so hopefully that'll be better now. And Doug, I hope that clarifies the question. That's why we have, but again, everything is based in the Torah. So that's why even the overriding law to temporarily suspend. Hello? Okay. Looks like we'll have to call back in. Just give me a moment. Thank you. Okay. Just one moment here. We have to call back into the conference call.
Welcome to the conference call. A service of www.freeconference.com. Please announce yourself.
Hi, it's Rabbi Gisman back. Everybody there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, sorry about that. I think my phone was having a little glitch. So let's pick up from where we were.
Wait, is that spirit too? Maybe he's calling you.
Rabbi, you're back. Okay.
Yeah, I think when my handset is done, so I'm using a different handset. Hopefully the sound is okay too now.
Okay.
All right, so we're continuing. Let's see, some people have audio, some people don't online. I'm not sure what the issue is. All right. Audio from this end. We're now resuming with Kehelis from last week. We're in chapter 5, verse 9. Okay. So I'll read it, and then we'll take up your observations and see if we can address it. So King Solomon continues now, and he says, one who loves silver or money will not be satisfied with money. And one who loves hamon, there's a dispute as to what hamon is. Some say accumulation, some say it means actual, Ibn Ezra says it means people, meaning a person likes to acquire servants and maidservants and waiters, that there should be people before him. He loves to have the people before him. So he says if a person loves that, he will not have any grain, meaning he won't have any food. And then he concludes, this also is a futility. So again, chapter 5, verse 9. One who loves money will not be satisfied, or is not satisfied with money. And one who loves either nice objects, some say jewels, pearls, nice precious stones and clothing, or it means that according to Ibn Ezra, he likes to have people before him, so he hires many servants. So if that's what the person loves, he will have no food. Okay.
Rabbi, is it only Ibn Ezra that concludes he'll have no food?
No, that's actually the verse. The verse says that. Lo tavua, he'll have
no food.
Go ahead.
My translation on the Judaica Press reads, whoever loves silver will not be sated with silver, okay. And he who loves a multitude without increase, this too is vanity.
That's not a good translation, because he's not saying, the word in the verse is tavua. And one who loves hamon, lo tavua, he'll have no grain. So you have to look at the commentators on that.
Okay.
Ibn Ezra says, he'll have no food. He'll have nothing by which to live. Sforno, I believe, says the same thing. Sforno says the same thing.
Okay.
Okay, let me see here what he's saying with the night. see if I can just increase the sound again for online. Device via. Okay. Let's see if that's any better. Okay. Those of you that are online, let me just an adjustment. Let me know if the sound is any louder now. I think it should have improved.
I think
okay. Everybody still there?
Yes, we are.
Okay. I am.
Okay. So now let's let me see if you have any questions on the verse or any you know, anything that it seems to be a problem.
I have a question. I mean, the first part makes complete sense. Whoever loves money will not be satisfied with money. I mean, that seems fairly straightforward.
It wasn't to me.
Well, it says you. Pardon?
I said it wasn't to me, but let me hear your question. Then you can go back and explain to
me.
Oh,
okay. I guess I'm hearkening back to maybe our study of Proverbs, but it would seem to me that a person that is in love with wealth, so wealth isn't exactly a thing. It's not a practical thing to consume. It is the stored up opportunity to do something else. And so a person that falls in love with that, I mean, we just see in the practical world that people who are very wealthy are not necessarily any more satisfied than people who are not. And so that wealth is not apparently satisfying to them. And even when they spend it on things, which generally would be either material things or certain physical experiences, you know, a really nice meal, a vacation, or whatever, that those things have a very short satisfaction length. And so ultimately, at the end of one experience, they're still dissatisfied because those experiences do not get to the core of what actually is the nature of man and how he's satisfied.
Good. Very well said. Okay. And we'll go with that.
Second.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Rabbi.
No, I was just going to say that we'll get to that more specific in a moment. But you had a second question, though?
Yeah, the part that bothers me is it says, he who loves a multitude will not have grain. And that one, I'm having a little difficulty seeing practically how that works, because if you take a very wealthy person who loves to be surrounded by other people, assuming that they manage their money with some amount of reasonableness, they'll still have money for food. Now, if a person is so into it that they just want to have maids, butlers, and servants all surrounding them and they pay no attention to their, you know, the cost of these people, I can see that. But I don't see that happening, at least based on my observations, a lot in the real physical world. So I'm sort of curious as to what he's getting at there.
I think it's the latter, what you said, that the person is an ohev. I mean, the key words, the key operative words in this verse is one who loves silver, one who loves to have people around. It means that he's putting a disproportionate amount of energy. As a matter of fact, he's putting all of his energy. When a person loves something, that's the sole focus. And in contrast, a person who doesn't love money or love dining, but it fits into a healthy lifestyle, then he can get satisfied through it. Here it's talking about the one who has a disproportionate amount of energy in these two areas. And yes, I mean, I actually was speaking to somebody yesterday, somebody I know personally, and he has been traveling the world and investing so much time and energy in building up a business, and at one point, you know, there were millions literally coming in. And I don't know what happened, but now the business had a fold, and he's going through, unfortunately going through a divorce. I'm not sure what, you know, I'm sure there's some relationship over there, but the bottom line is that maybe he put all that energy into the business, building it up, and didn't really pay attention to the bigger picture, like having his basic needs. So it could be that could be an example, an illustration of what he's saying over here, that there is a personality type like that. That somebody who loves to have people. And that's what Ibn Ezra says. What does it mean that he loves the hamon? Hamon means people. He won't have any grain, he won't have food. So Ibn Ezra says, we explain the word hamon to mean the acquisition of servants, maidservants, and butlers, many butlers. And the matter is that he loves that there should be people before him. So this, his satisfaction of what? This is basically ego. He's satisfying these certain people that they have distorted personalities, and there's something which appeals to them a lot more than other people. Maybe the mainstream people are more in tune to taking care of the basic necessities, but then there's some people that can be very bent, and I've seen it. I've seen people that the egos are really just thirsty as anything, and they're probably in their positions because they wanted that, and they act that way, and everything out of their mouth is another attempt to knock somebody else down and bolster themselves, and I've seen it. Unfortunately, it happens. So just to answer your second question, Doug, you can't have that. I don't think he's saying that. Yeah, I don't think he's saying that this is a majority of cases. He's isolating a, you know, specific phenomena here.
I see.
There are people like that. Some people are very happy just being alone with a friend or their wife, and that's you know, very satisfying. It's a healthy personality. Some people know they've got to have position. It has to be people underneath them that line up before them, that they can tell them what to do, and that's what gives them their sense of well-being. Now they feel good, so they're very corrupt. They're serving themselves as opposed to serving God. But let's go back to the first thing you also mentioned regarding one who loves silver or money. It's not really, it's really, see, the problem there is there's a displacement like you started getting onto. You can't eat the silver. It's not really going to cater to what your real needs are, which the commentaries also say. So a number of things we have to understand is what causes this love of money? Where is it coming from? Number two, why doesn't it satisfy? And maybe there's a few reasons why it doesn't satisfy. So what you were saying was very good. That if a person does not understand human psychology, he's not going to understand what really satisfies a person. So the main components we need to understand is the drive of a person and satisfaction. And they're intimately, you know, related. And when we say drive of a person, it means that a person has energy. Everybody has a tremendous amount of energy. And if the energy of a person, and we're not talking mystical or cosmic here, we're talking about psychologically. A person has desires, he has drive psychologically. And that's how we're designed, is to have that in order to propel us every day of our lives for the many, many decades that we're here. We need to have drive to go after things. And there are many emotions that God incorporated into our psyche. Progress, the need for accomplishment. Ego has its place in it as well. And of course, they're all necessary. It just there has to be the proper balance. But that drive is something which is continual. And what happens is, if the drive is not being satisfied, so that's called frustration. When a person's energies are not being outletted in a manner that satisfies these different areas, whether it's accomplishment this day, or progress, or a person can also be a very, very healthy lifestyle, doing all the right things, but he wants a little change of scenery, so that he needs to. He has to know what time he has to cater to what. For example, a person could even use that as the wrong thing. A person travels and travels and travels, and he's got all the money to do it, but his sense of accomplishment starts to kick in, and he feels like he wants to get back because he's not satisfying that part of himself. So there has to be a balance. And of course, the Torah system gives that to us in the various parts of the day, in our activities, the advice of the rabbis are all to gear us towards that. So what would be an example of somebody who's frustrated? You ever hear the term, somebody went postal?
Yep.
Right, so what does that mean? Yeah, and you hear this, it's not just once, you hear this a number of times that people who are postmen, they go berserk and they shoot people. They shoot down people in their office or wherever it is. Why is this? It's in this area. That type of a profession leads to that. Why is that?
Could that be because the person is so not fulfilling the need for some type of accomplishment or the nature of a true human being that it's that frustration is building up inside of him, and finally it gets so great that it just explodes.
Right, and I'll say specifically where it comes from is monotonous activity. He's doing the exact same route, the exact same activity, day in, day out, day in, day out. See, a person has a need. That shows you that a person has a need to have a certain amount of freedom, a certain amount of diversity. You know, variety is the spice of life. That basically sums it up, this specific point. But there has to be a change. There has to be something which refreshes the person. And you see, that's exactly what Torah does. Torah is something which, again, the person's core is really the intelligence. The person knows that. Rabbi Chaim once said that you can show a person what they really sense is the self, is their intellect. Because if you say to a person, hey, you're eating like a pig, as opposed to saying, hey, you're stupid, so it's much more of an insult to call a person stupid, because now you're insulting what he senses is really the him. So I'm eating like a pig, I can change that, you know, it's just a small activity. That's not all of me. But if you say, I am stupid, so now the person senses that that's the part of the self that's really the center. And what goes along with that is that if that center, that part of the person is not being satisfied, so what a person typically does in our society is they make wrong assumptions as to where the happiness comes from. So they try different activities. But what happens is, if they become the lover of money, so now they feel that this is going to give them everything that they need. So it's a mistake, because it's not satisfying that part of them. And there's also this concept of needing to be stimulated regularly. What that basically describes is the emotion of novelty. You could have anything new. You could buy a new house, new car, have all the wealth, and how long could a person walk around his new house and be satisfied? He needs to have, you know, he'll do it for an hour. Finally, day after day, after a few weeks, he can't just keep walking around that same house. I don't care how beautiful and luxurious it is. Same thing with the car. Because the stimulus is no longer there. He is already familiar with it. You know, they say a familiarity breeds contempt. That there's something which is not satisfying now with something which is familiar to you. When something is still new, so there's stimulus. Hey, I didn't see this part of the house. I didn't see that. I didn't try this part of the car, whatever it is. But then there's a limit to what those things really contain. Now where is the stimulus going to come from? The energy that is driving the person to have new stimulus now comes to an end in any one of these activities. But Torah is the one thing, or wisdom in general, is where the person, number one, the essential part of the person, the intellect, is engaged. And when he ponders new ideas, there's stimulus at every corner. So that's why it's not something which ever causes him to wane. It's just the opposite. He gets more intrigued. Hey, this is interesting. And it actually satisfies all the energies. The energies can go further and further because there's no end to the wisdom that he's penetrating. Any area, whether it's biology, whether it's the Talmud, whether it's, you know, the philosophy of King Solomon. You're talking about, you know, God's wisdom, so if one idea is going to lead to the next. And that constant flow of interest is not getting frustrated, because it is a constant flow. More and more doors open up. So this gives full satisfaction to the person. The only thing is that he may have to go to sleep at night because he's tired, and that's the way the body is. But he gets up the next day, he's refreshed, and he's interested to go further. And that's really where the satisfaction will come. So this explains why, if you love, and there's another reason too, why if you love money, you won't be satisfied. Like you were saying, Doug, that if you're just loving objects, there's only so much the object can give you until it becomes familiar, and it lacks the stimulus in order to cater to that drive, that constant flow of energy that everybody has until we die. That has to be satisfied. So that's why the postal worker that's doing the same activities over and over, it just is frustrating because there's no, his soul is not being refreshed. There's nothing new. So that drive has been stunted, and he just gets completely frustrated, and then there's an explosion. So the dissatisfaction, and maybe expresses it towards people because he's catering to these people. That became the source of his problem. But also, like you said, Doug, the reason for silver or money not being something, if a person loves money, why is he not satisfied with it? Because it's a trick of the mind. The person thinks that it is the money that's going to give him the happiness. But it's not. It's really what he'll do with the money. And like Swarno says, he says on verse 9, this is not the end of the line. Meaning the money is not really what he's looking for. It's what he's going to do with it. Now, again, once he has, say a person, there's another thing I just want to mention, is that a person who doesn't have money and then feels if I had it, life would be great. The reason why he's not happy once he gets it is because he made a mistake. His mistake was that he was in a state of deprivation. He had very little money. And he felt, well, if he had money now, I would be in a prolonged state of happiness. No, that's not true. All the money is going to do is get you out of your state of deprivation. But that's not the whole need of a human being. That's one thing. One thing is to have a roof over your head, to have money. And once you have that, that's not going to give you happiness. But the mistake that people make is they look at the one thing that they're missing, and they say, if I had that one thing, that's all I need to be happy. Because they're just faced with that. It's right in their face at this time. Like a person who can have a certain sickness, and I just want to, get rid of this illness, and I'll be happy forever. Well, they get rid of the illness, but that doesn't satisfy every other part of the mind. So it's a mistake that the person makes. You see? So that's why... Yeah, go ahead, Doug. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask, so on the postal part, are there, in fact, people whose, psyche or personality or whatever is made up such that the monotony of that kind of work is more conducive to them than something that requires them to think creatively and deal with new things all the time?
Yeah, you mean, are there people that are more fit for that type of job?
Right.
Well, for sure. I mean, if they gravitated to it, I mean, it could be a number of reasons. Either because it's easy, they don't have to think, and they're more mechanical. And I think Maimonides even talks about this, that God made different personality types because it's necessary. If everybody was interested in medicine, you couldn't live in the world. You'd have no plumbing system. You'd have no people constructing houses. So therefore, there's a diversity of likes. You see that God created human beings. They have very diverse interests. However, sometimes people pick something because of the wrong reasons, and they get frustrated. Some people, that's all they want. They're very happy doing the same, paper-pushing job, and it doesn't meet with a tremendous frustration. I'm sure there is some frustration because everybody exact same components to the mind. Some may just have more of a degree than another person, which is definitely the fact. But a person should be choosing. Yeah, a person should be choosing something which he's measuring in himself. Let me see if I like it. I always tell people, I think it's a mistake that people go, that kids go from high school to college, and then they work. It should really be the opposite. You're done with high school, start working in a field that you like, or try a few things. Once you've actually engaged in it, then maybe you'll need some knowledge. So buy a book. So this way you have some knowledge. This way you can start working, at the bottom of the ladder in the field that you think you may like. try it out. Try it for a year, two, three, whatever it is. If you like it, then go to school. But it's just the opposite. I've heard some of the cases, people go to law school for a number of years, they finally get into law, and they just can't stand it. So they wasted 3 years in law school. And it literally, it could be real waste if they don't use it. So a person has to gauge himself or herself what is good in terms of what my, you know, my enjoyments are. Is this going to be satisfying to me? And then, you know, pursue the necessary schooling and the money to pay for the school. All right, that's just a parenthetical. Okay, so the points we made so far is that the person who doesn't have the money, who King Solomon is addressing over here, he's trying to show them that you're making a mistake. If you love money and that's what you're going after, it's not going to satisfy you. Because that's really the primary reason, is that is not the object that you're looking for. You're looking to compensate for what you are deprived, the area that you're deprived. The money doesn't do it, it's something else. So loving money can't give you, once you have the money, just having it is not going to satisfy you. Because that's not the object you initially were going for. So you see that people have the money and they go on expensive vacations and they go here and they go, they're not satisfied. It doesn't really do it. And that's because they've missed the point as to what really gives satisfaction. And a person's constructed that the energies have to flow into an area that you can keep on, you can sustain the interest in that area. And that's what wisdom is. Okay, now Laura has a question online. She's writing, regarding something which stunts a person, and then there's an explosion. Isn't the explosion shown in the next verse where it says, fear God? Let's see, the next verse says, when there's an increase in the good, meaning money, so then also the consumers increase. And therefore, King Solomon says, I'm reading verse 5:10 now. So when there's an increase in goods, so then there's an increase in the consumers. And therefore, what good is there to the owner, except for what his eyes see? So I don't see what you're referring to there. And next question is, the military assigns different job assignments according to the person's IQ. Therefore, the recruiting offices are given different levels of needed IQs. Right, that's to the point that the military understands that people have different advantages psychologically. So they'll profile, you know, people who join and use them the best they can. Okay. I know, but you were saying verse 6. So let me see. Verse 6 is talking about something else there, Laura. Verse 6, we explain to mean where the emotions and speech and dreams are all coming from a very convoluted emotional state. And the people who speak a lot, they're really just acting in the same capacity as they do when they're asleep, where there's no control over their instincts. That's why he equates with a multitude of dreams and futilities and many, many words. Rather, you should fear God. That's a different point altogether. Okay, Laura? Okay. All right. Okay, so the love of money, we explained. And there's another thing, too. A person fantasizes, you know, before a person has money, so he feels, you know, that's why the lottery is such an appealing thing. People feel, well, if I had all that money, well, what would I do with that? The bottom line is, you're going to get bored. You can go on a few trips, you can buy that great house, you can buy that beautiful car. Now, what else are you going to spend that money on? Really, once you have all you need, some beautiful clothing, very good. You can't just walk around in your clothing and drive your beautiful car and look at your beautiful house all day. That does not satisfy a person. It's exciting for the moment. But the energies, again, are going to get frustrated in the physical. It's only when the person uses the physical properly, and that's what this book started out saying. All right, that's like Rabbi Chait explained. The beginning verse of this, chapter 1, verse 1, reads as follows. And the rabbis asked a very strong question on King Solomon for making a statement. The very first, second verse, excuse me. First verse says, these are the words of Kohelis, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. So the reason why Solomon was called Kohelis is because Kohelis means that he spoke in groups. Kehila, or Kohelis, means lots of people. So he spoke in a manner where there was a lot of people to listen and to sound off his ideas. So they weren't just his own subjective ideas, but there was a sounding board. So he had the wisest men of Jerusalem to converse with. And if there was anything wrong, they would have told him. But they accepted his book. Now, what does he say in verse 2? Chapter 1, verse 2. All is futile, says Kohelis, meaning King Solomon. The futility of futilities. All is futile. So the number of times it refers to futility, if you count the plural form and the singular form, is 7. And it's an allusion to the 7 days of creation. So the rabbis are saying, how can God say in Genesis, after every day, he says, behold, it was good. After the creation of everything, God continuously says that the creation is good. And King Solomon comes along and says everything is futile, and he's talking about the number 7, meaning referring to the 7 days, of the 6 days of creation, and the seventh day of rest, where that's where all the physical was created. And now King Solomon sounds like he's violating God's words. He's saying everything is futile. So the Rebbe Shade explained that King Solomon is talking about when you go after the physical as an ends in itself, that's when it's a futility. And that's very much to our point here. When God said that everything is good, meaning it's good if it's used properly in the pursuit of a life of wisdom. God grants only human beings intelligence. That's because we're to engage that over all else. The physical world, of course, is necessary as a means. So that's why it's a good if it's used as a means. But King Solomon is talking about when you go after things as an end in themselves. Then it's a futility. And Rabbi Chase said a brilliant point. He said, in that verse itself, he says one more thing. He says, and there's a futility of the futility. Now, I don't know if you remember what we said on this. Do you remember? What is the futility of the physical world? I understand the physical world doesn't end. If I'm just trying to have a eat, drink, and be merry, and engage all my lusts and all my desires, and just lead a physical, hedonistic lifestyle, so that's going to be a futility. That's true, of course. We explained that. But what is the futility of that? You remember what we said?
We talked about the one futility being chasing after the physical world as the ultimate, and that the futility of futilities is the fantasy that the person has around that.
Exactly. Right. Meaning, the King Solomon was pointing to, and that's such a brilliant insight that Rabbi Chait offered, that he saw, because King Solomon saw the entire personality. He was one of the wisest men ever. He was given wisdom overnight when he was 12 years old. King David had died, and before he died, he appointed his son Solomon to be the king, and he was only 12 years old. And God came to him in a vision at the night and asked Solomon, says, ask what I should give to you. That's what God said to King Solomon. So he asked for wisdom to judge the people. So miraculously, this one time in history, God granted tremendous wisdom to a human being, and didn't acquire it through the natural process. So you see that he had tremendous wisdom, and he was able to say that not only is the physical life as an end in itself is going to be a futility and a frustrating type of endeavor, but people think into it and they make fantasies about it too. That itself is another layer of futility. It's just the engagement of a person in fantasizing, meaning the person who buys a lottery ticket. So his whole week is in that second futility, that fantasy about, oh, if I have it, this and that. And so that's a waste of time as well. That's a waste. You can't make up lost time. So you see, he gets to that point here in our verse, which is 5:9, about if you love silver, it's not going to satisfy you. But you see, there's two things. There's the loving of the silver, and then there's also the ego, according to Ibn Ezra, the second part. And a person who loves to have people around him, ministering before him, so this too is going to be a waste. Okay. again, this is all based on where human satisfaction is, it comes from, is that the drive, which is a never-ending flow of energy, has to be tapped properly. And it's not going to be tapped properly unless the person has the ability to be involved in wisdom. And there, his energies can get completely immersed and completely satisfied. There's no satisfaction like that. Because there's nothing halting. As Rabbi Chaim once said, even if a person learns and he makes a mistake, when he sees a mistake he made, that too is learning. He just learned a new thing. He learned that his assumption was wrong. That is a new piece of acquired knowledge, and that's an insight. And when you see something new, it's like a light goes off in your head. It's very enlightening. I mean, had an example over Shabbos this past week. And it's amazing how you can go through the Chumash, you can go through the Torah. Let me just say this one question. Avner, you're writing, this may not be an addition to what has been said so far, but one of the greatest pleasures about making money is the game itself. At the end, the money turns out to be just numbers. Having constructive things to do with it, then will add pleasure back again to the money. Having constructive things to do with it, will add pleasure back again to the money. All right, there definitely is satisfaction. But you're right, your point is good, is that the game, meaning people love that. Even if you've got tons of money, you see the people working into their 80s, because there, that's satisfying a real need, the accomplishment aspect of a person. I remember Rabbi Chaim saying too, you know, once said, retirement is not a good idea, because retirement is now basically committing yourself to, you know, writing off that need of accomplishment, of progress. So it's true. What I was going to mention, you know, just as a, because, you know, I think we explained the verse here, and if you have any questions or comments, you let me know, but just as an example of something which is, you know, never-ending, you know, you go through the plagues, you know, twice a year, as we, you know, there's a command to read the Torah portion each week, and we complete the entire Torah in the cycle of the whole year. But we also, not only do these past 2 weeks, we're reading about the 10 plagues, but when Passover comes, we're going through it again, the Seder, the two nights of the Passover Seder. So we're going through the plagues again. And you think after a few decades of doing that, twice a year you might exhaust, you know, the insights. And it just happened this week, you know, where a question came up, you know, what was Moses doing with the staff? Why does God tell him, and take the staff with you when you go do the miracles? And then Ibn Ezra has a commentary, and he talks about which plagues were done with the staff and which were not done with the staff. And he makes a point of it. So, and I never saw this one before. You think the staff, right, you know, I mean, the staff originated, Moses just happened to have the staff, and he was herding the sheep or whatever it was, the flock, and it was in his hand. So when he said that, you know, the Jews, they won't believe that God appeared to me or spoke to me, he had a number of questions. He was debating with God about this whole mission. He did not want to take on this role. So God responded to each one of those questions. In terms of his speech, Aaron will speak for you. And in terms of going before Pharaoh, God said, I'm going to make you very impressive in Pharaoh's eyes, that he won't have the ability to kill you or hurt you in any way, so you'll be able to stand before him. And in terms of proof to the people that I spoke to you, you'll remind them of the promise of Jacob, that I surely remembered you, and also I'm going to give you these signs. So he told him one of the signs is take the staff that you have in your hand and throw it to the ground, and it became a snake. So this became the beginning of the importance of the staff, but that was now used initially when he went to Paro, that it turned into a snake. So Paro's magicians also, they used sleight of hand, and they were able to, you know, just like a magician can pull out a card from the middle of the air, from nowhere, so they were able to take a stick, and then very quickly, with sleight of hand, put a snake down in its place. And, you know, the onlooker didn't see how fast they did it, so it looked like the staff turned into a snake. Therefore, Moses' staff swallowed up those two to show there was a different thing that Moses was doing. So, but then the staff also had, it was an interesting thing, that why did he have to take it with him and all the other miracles? And it's interesting what the Ibn Ezra says. He says that the staff was used to smite the water, to turn it to blood, to bring up the frogs, to turn the sand into lice, And then also to bring down the locusts from the wind, to bring the hail down from the sky, to bring about the darkness. But he says there were two plagues, or three plagues, that didn't have the staff. And that was the mixture of wild animals and the plague of the animal deaths of Egypt. So you see, Ebenezer is using ink over here to indicate that there's something more. And, you know, there's so much going on. I guess you just can't get everything every year. But we had the question. Why were those two plagues bereft of a staff? And again, you got to be careful with Ibn Ezra's words. He says that the staff was used to smite the Nile, to bring out the frogs, to turn the sand into the lice, to bring about the locust with the wind, to induce the darkness, and to bring the hail down from the sky. He doesn't just say that the staff was used by lice, frogs, blood. No, he says the staff was used to bring about, to turn something into this, to induce the darkness. What is he saying? What's his idea there? And he doesn't, and the staff is not used when God brought about the wild animals, or when the plague of the animal deaths. There the staff was not used. Separate reason why it wasn't used by the death of the firstborns, because that was God. God says, I'm going to smite the firstborns, me and not an angel, me and not any other force. I'm going to do it. So therefore, it was not a plague that Moses was involved in. So therefore, staff didn't play a role because it wasn't Moses doing it. So that we can leave out the plague of the firstborn, but by the wild animals that came in and attacked the Egyptians, and the death of all the cattle and the livestock, why was the staff not used there?
Those the only plagues involving other living creatures.
I thought about that first too, but then I realized that frogs and lice and locusts also are living creatures.
Well, yeah, that's true.
But you may be onto something.
Well, I mean, obviously they're big creatures versus frogs and lice, which are little creatures, but I can't immediately see why that would make a difference.
Yeah. Well, I can't.
Well, in the one case at least, the animals are relied upon by the Egyptians. They didn't rely on frogs and lice, but they relied on their cattle.
What do you mean they relied on them?
And the wild animals, the plague of the wild animals, they themselves, the Egyptians themselves, were in danger from those, yes?
Yes. It seems so. And Avner, I see a question online. I'll get to that in a second. So I think there's two things going on here with the staff. So this is the significance of the staff. Evidently, it was mandatory that not only that first, you know, God told Moses to throw the staff down when Paro, you know, asks you for a sign or whatever, and it'll turn into a snake. But God didn't first tell Moses that the staff is also going to swallow up Paro's snakes. That happened at that moment, right? So why did that have to happen? You must say that there had to be a significance still credited to Moses and Aaron. Because if the Egyptians went ahead and the astrologers, the magicians, they were able to somehow duplicate it, And to the eyes of the onlooker of Paro, they were satisfied, hey, it's close enough, we can do the same thing. So maybe Moses is also using sleight of hand. And keep in mind, they had no powers. Sadia Gomez says openly that all the duplication that they did, they used sleight of hand. And they made the water duplication turn into blood because they used red dyes. And they were able to make the frogs jump out of the water because they put chemicals in the water that repelled the frogs, like allergic reaction. Sadia Gomez says clearly, they have no, and of course it makes sense, they have no power. Okay. But I think what's going on, there may be two things here. Number one, like you're saying, Doug, that perhaps by the animals that attacked, the mixture of animals. So why was there a mixture of animals? Why was that one of the plagues? So there are many things that God was addressing. He wasn't just trying to destroy the Egyptians. He was trying to educate. God says openly, in order that I multiply my wonders, in order that my name should be spoken in all the land. People should be very impressed. But you can only be very impressed if you see many insights into how God is really the sole ruler. But there had to be other things broken down. For example, the Nile River was a god to them. So that was the first thing. That has to be shown that the Nile River, it's something else is power of the Nile River. But there's also another, there was another angle too, that the Egyptians viewed their astrologers, the magicians, as an elite class. That's why they had great positions with Paro. And you see after the plague of boils that these Khartoumim, the astrologers, were not mentioned anymore after that plague. Now what happens in that plague? After the boils come to Egypt, it says that the astrologers could not stand before Moses because the boils were on them and on the Egyptians. Now I don't understand two things. Boils don't stop you from standing up. So what do you mean? That they couldn't stand before Moses because of boils? That's not a problem in terms of a person's posture. That's a surface thing. It has to do with your epidermis, your skin. So if I get blisters all over my skin, I can still stand up. And secondly, what do I care that the... What does the verse tell me? They couldn't stand before Moses because of the boils were on the astrologers and on the rest of the Egyptians. Well, who cares if the boils were on the rest of the Egyptians? That has nothing to do with the astrologers coming before Moses. So there's two things in the verse, but what you now you realize, it's not talking about they couldn't stand before Moses in terms of posture. It means they couldn't face Moses. They lost face. Because now that they, see the end of the verse says, because the boils were on them and the Egyptians, it's trying to show you there was an equation. That they, the astrologers and the Egyptians had boils equally. Meaning to say that the astrologers were no better. They couldn't get rid of the boils. They were powerless. And because of that, now they couldn't face Moses. That's what it means they couldn't stand before Moses. They couldn't come before him. There was no way they can carry themselves as being great magicians anymore. You can't even get rid of your own boils. You're just like the rest of the populace. So you see that plague of boils targeted the astrologers. That was another element of what God was doing, was to reduce this deification of people. Not only to smite the Nile River, but there were many aspects of the plagues. And you see that when Paro first saw the plague of blood, and it bothered him, it says, V'ifin Paro v'yavu abesa, that Paro turned to the side, he turned away and he went into his house. Why is the Torah telling us that he went into his house? So a man explained, he was trying to avoid the reality of what happened with the plague of blood. That's why the next plague of frogs came about. I mean, that was something which the Torah says, it entered into the house and into the bedroom and into the ovens, meaning here there was no escape. Power, you want to act that way? You want to try to have a certain response to blood? So the next plague is going to address that. The plague of hail, too. It was, Moses says, after the plague of hail is coming down, he says to Power, funny thing, he says, all the plants that were stiff are broken because of the hail. But the plants that were still fresh and not yet fully ripe, so they were still very green and soft, so the hail didn't destroy them because they were soft. What is Moses telling him about agricultural phenomena for? But he's not. He was using, see that's where Moses had to be the one that performed the plagues. Not performed them, but appointed the times to Paro. Because then when he comes before Paro, he shows the insight to the plague. God is trying to address your obstinate nature, Paro. If you're going to be stiff like these plants, look what happened to the plants. They're broken. If you're flexible, before God, then you'll bend back like these other plants. So you see, every plague had a tremendous amount of information. And you have to study the verses to see it. So you keep that in mind. But now let's get back to our question over here. So the mixture of the animals, why was it a mixture? Why wasn't it just one species? So a mixture is because the Egyptians deified the animals. And if you look at the headdress of the Egyptian paros, you see that one of the species they had on the headdress was a snake. And I think it was Rashi that says that the mixture of animals was scorpions and snakes. So what was God doing with this plague? If you get attacked by something which you previously deified, it's going to dilute and maybe even permanently remove your deification of that species. Now, if it's only one species, then the problem is, well, I'll still reserve my deification of the other species. But if God makes a plague where it's a mixture of animals coming and attacking you, so now it generally removes your attachment to animals in a general sense, which was the objective over here by Orov. So that gives insight into why those, you know, why that plague was given to them, because that was another aspect that had to be addressed, you know, the deification of animals. But why wasn't the stick used? Why wasn't Moses' staff used there? So one thing is, you could say, is that if he uses a staff, which turned into a snake, and Paro remembers that, so he may be attached to that staff now in the face of the other animals that are he's removing his energies from. But I think there's another idea. I think a staff also works as, like what Ibn Ezra says, he hit the waters, and he hit the sand, and it turned into lice, and he put it up to the sky, and then the wind blew in the locusts, and he waved it to the sky, and the burad, the hail, came down. Why is the staff used? Perhaps it's used as a pointer. What do I mean? It sounds simple, but maybe not. That he's using the staff as a way of indicating, look over here, like when a person puts out their index finger, why can't they just raise their hand with a closed fist? Because that doesn't indicate pointing. Instinctually, even children, you can see, they put out their index finger when they're trying to show something to the mother or father. Instinctually, a person understands that it's you're putting your arm in a certain direction, but when you put your finger out, that means follow my finger, follow the path of my arm, and look what's happening. Look at where I'm directing it. So the staff was now an indicator that Moses is now telling the power and all the Egyptians, God is now going to take this and convert it, and there's going to be a change here. Look at the waters. Look at the sand. Meaning all the different elements of the earth. That's where the first three had to do with the earth, because the plagues, as Rabbi Chet explained, there's an acronym for the plagues. For each, there's really groups of three. The first three, the second three, and the third three. The last one of killing the firstborns, Rabbi Chet explained, was brought about to end the proliferation of the Egyptian culture. So you kill out the leaders, the firstborns. But the rabbis, they gave an acronym for each one of the plagues. And the first three, what's the reason behind the acronym? Not just to remember it, but because they were done in groups. The first three were performed by Aaron, and they had to do with the earthly substances, either water or sand. The first was blood, which was the waters were smitten. And then you have frogs also came from the water, and then you have lice, which came from the earth. And Aaron did those three. The last three had to do with the heavens. You had the locusts were blown in by wind, hail comes from the heavens, and darkness is an atmospheric thing. And those were all done by Moses, not Aaron. Then the intermediary plagues have to do with what happens on the surface of the earth, meaning the animals and the plague of the animals, the wild animals that attack them, and then the boils. So Ibn Ezra explains that that's to show you that just like Aaron was lower than Moses in for intelligence, so he worked the plagues that have to do with lower substances, meaning just the earth and water. Moses, who was a higher level, he dealt with the plagues that are in the heavens to show that he was at a higher level. But there was a plague where they did something together, which was the boils. Why? In order to show that, nonetheless, all is created by God. All is controlled by God, whether it's the earth, whether it's the heavens. And everything that happens in between, meaning the what happens on the surface of the earth, meaning the animals' activity, so on, and the boils. So that's to show you that God is controlling all three areas. What's on earth, what's above the earth and the heavens, and everything in between. Just to give you insight into the plagues as well. But, what I'm saying about the staff, why does Ibn Ezra point out, and he says, he brought this plague with them, he brought that plague, and he pointed over here, because part of the these plagues was to indicate how God was manipulating different elements. So he pointed to the element, and then all of a sudden they saw a change. And he pointed over here with the staff, and there's a change. So why didn't he use the staff by the wild animals and the plague? I think it's because there they were different. There was no source to point to. Hey, you get the point. You don't know where the animals are coming from. So you can't point left, right, up and down. They just came. And a plague also. You can't point at disease. So here he didn't use a staff. Now that put him off kilter. And it's also in connection with animals too. That there was something that this God, that Moses is an emissary, that there was a certain sense that they got in terms of certain plagues. He pointed at things and then they turned. But when it came to animals, things that they deified, things that they had this relationship to, there was an insecurity now. So there was no pointing. There was no source to where the plague came from. So there was nothing to point to. You see what I'm saying? Let me stop here. Stop here and see if there's any questions.
I have one question. There's something you said earlier about with regard to the animals, that they deified those. And so if you're in a situation where you're deifying an animal and then it turns on you, that will break your deification of it?
Right.
Did I understand that correctly?
Yes.
So wouldn't there also be a possibility that you would assume, oh, well, that deity must be mad at me, as opposed to say, gee, if it's going to bite me, maybe it isn't a deity after all?
Evidently not. I mean, if it's mad at you, and it doesn't say openly in the verses that it killed them, but the wild animals or snakes or scorpions, as Rashi says, clearly those things are poisonous. My assumption is that the goal is really to, if something's going to be mad at you and then kills you, there's really no benefit anymore. There's only benefit in something being mad at you if it allows you time to correct your ways.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Okay, let me just take and see, there's a couple questions on the screen. Avner, you're writing that you derive pleasure from studying Torah, going through all the nuances and details, but then I tend to believe that my own personality, that this is my own personality, and I question whether any of the human beings would have the same traits. Okay, so of course, everybody has the same traits, Avner. I mean, we all have the same design, just like everybody has a heart and two lungs and so on and so forth. So the same psychological makeup exists in every human being. Okay, so everybody has that same satisfaction, not just you. The next question is...
What was the question again?
Avner was writing on screen whether or not he enjoys pleasure, he said, from studying Torah, but he's just wondering if other people have that as well. So I'm answering him that, yes, anytime that a person experiences something, everybody on earth has the same potential for that experience because we're all the same exact design. Okay, some people just have to cultivate it more, or some people may have a greater degree of it from the outset, but everybody has the, let's call it the psychological apparatus, the psychological faculty, just like everybody has the same limbs, the same organs. So psychologically, the same thing is true. That's why you could have one Torah given to millions of people, because it has the same benefits for all. Okay. Next question is, Moses was at the end of the staff. God was at the end of the other two plagues. God was at the end of the other two plagues. I'm not sure what the idea is there. Tina is writing, because the Egyptians worshipped many types of animals. Okay, so you're answering about why they had the wild animals. Right. Okay. And, yep, after everybody has the same capacity. That's, again, I mean, God only created one type of human being. So that means we all have the same capacity. That's why there's one Torah supposed to be for everybody. In the future, you know, all people are going to recognize the Torah's truth. That can only be true if everybody has the same ability, the same, you know, faculties of the mind and the psyche. I mean, when we look at different people, you know, some people could be as different as black and white. You know, that some people could be so, you know, simplistic and brutish. And then you have people that are so refined and intellectual. I mean, it's a very, you know, large range, you know, from one end to the other. The spectrum of, you know, human personalities is very, very large. It's a very wide spectrum. But nonetheless, like Maimonides says, you know, people can cultivate what maybe they have in a more reduced form at their birth. People are different at birth. But you can definitely cultivate the abilities. But everybody has the same capacity. Everybody has anger. Everybody has love. It's just a matter of where it's directed or how a person uses it. Many factors. Okay. All right, let me see if there's any other questions or comments. Okay, so maybe we should wrap it up here. I know you get the class Rabbi Moskowitz coming up. So we'll continue next week, and we're going to be up to verse 5:10, right? That's where we're up to? 5:10. It'll be a continuation of this theme of money. We'll do that next week. But the reason I brought in the whole thing of the plagues is just from my personal experience, how, you know, something which is so basic, and not only is it so basic, you see that Ibn Ezra, you know, like Maimonides says, is the greatest commentator on the Torah. He actually goes into showing you, here's a list of all the plagues, and these had the staff, and these didn't. So he's taking time to, so this is a very important concept. And, you know, just year after year, you're just bowled over by, you know, really new, you know, primary ideas, which is just amazing. And this is to the point that this is where we can derive, you know, the energy, the satisfaction of our energy. And it's not going to be through the other areas. The other areas are to complement it, to go out for a nice dinner, to have a change of scenery, to do a vacation. But, you know, the person has to have
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
So the person has to have the realization that the center, the core of his life is really, you know, the pursuit of wisdom. That will keep him constantly on track. It'll educate him in terms of changing his wrong ways. It'll give him new insights into his personality. It'll satisfy his energies on a daily basis, so he has that daily satisfaction. It just benefits him in every way possible. So you're very fortunate for that. All right, so we'll wrap it up here, and we will continue next week. All right, if anybody missed any part of it, we'll put this online shortly. So if you missed part of it, it'll be available in the audio section, so you can hear it. All right, so good week to everybody.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi. You have a great week, too.
Okay, everybody, be well.
Great week. Bye.
Bye-bye.